Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What is today? The 9th for this Wednesday, the 9th of June. This first part of the program today, Jonathan Alter is joining us. Jonathan is the author most recently of The Promise, President Obama Year One. He, of course, is well-known to American audiences. He's a senior editor at Newsweek. He writes a highly praised column on politics, history, media, and society at large. And he's also an analyst and contributing correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC. He wrote a terrific book about FDR, the defining moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, which was a national bestseller. He's a Midwestern guy at heart because he's from the Chicago. He's from Chicago. And he's our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send us an email, that's okay. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Jonathan. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm a great admirer of your work. There's certain people you just like to listen to, and you say, Jonathan's on. I'd like to hear what he has to say.
Well, that's so nice of you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, it's true. I wouldn't say it if it weren't true. And I really like the book. It was a year, but what a year. It's just so complete and in-depth, and there's a lot here. But there's a lot to this guy, isn't there? I mean, there are all kinds of levels here of trying to govern in a different way and how he governs and the issues that are important and who he is and the staff. And it's a lot. It's good for a journalist like you.
Well, you know, I guess I'm maybe because I've been interested in history my whole life. I'm very sensitive to the idea of when history is being made. Mm-hmm. And I've been at Newsweek for close to 30 years, and there's some years when not a lot of history is being made, and there are other years when we know we're going to look back and say, wow, that was a seriously eventful year. And 2009 was one of those, and it turned out that Barack Obama is already a historic president for reasons beyond the color of his skin. And,
right.
And so I just thought that that was a big story, and I wanted to be on it. And I had to write history in a hurry. I was trying to kind of take off my pundit cap and put on my reporter cap and just go out and try to tell people what was happening when you pull back the curtain, you know, behind mm-hmm. the scenes. In these many great events of 2009, preventing another Great Depression, deciding whether to escalate in Afghanistan, and lots of other things.
You talk, and let's talk more about this, about Obama thinking that you are reminded of the song Dem Bones, the knee bones connected to the thigh bone. Da, da, da,
right, right.
That Obama believed in the 21st century, all the big problems were directly connected to one another. In what way does he believe that? It strikes me as though it's also difficult to govern that way, because in some ways, with all the news cycles, we want things to be incredibly simplistic. But in a way, he's right on with this, that things are connected to one another.
Well, that tension between the simplistic news cycle, as you put it, and the complexity of the problems between a short-term 24/7 cable news view of the world and a long-term, decades-long view of the world, between dealing with issues in silos as independent from one another and dealing with them in an interconnected way. All of those tensions are part of the story. And so, you know, those are some of the themes that run through all of these behind-the-scenes anecdotes. But I think he did sense that, you know, take something like the oil spill, that, you know, our energy use is connected to our economy, our future prosperity, if we can develop a clean energy, and that if we can get our economy going again with the help of this 21st century technology, then that in turn would help us reduce the deficit. And if we get control of healthcare costs, we not only can provide more people with coverage and more peace of mind, but we can begin to put ourselves on a more sustainable path fiscally, which, as the president explained to me, you know, was a big part of his motivation for tackling health care in 2009, over the objections of pretty much everybody around him, which to me was a big revelation. You know, Rahm Emanuel told me, quote, "I begged the president not to do this," you know. So one of the reasons he went ahead is because he does see everything as interconnected. And he said to me at one point, you know, if we don't get control of health care costs long term, it will consume 70% of non-defense spending. And then he paused, you know, in one of those wingback chairs in the Oval Office and said, 70%. So he's trying to look ahead, look down the road, and the Dem Bones analogy was mine, but it parallels his thinking on this.
Yeah. He doesn't suffer fools gladly, and he doesn't like, as you write about extensively, the fact that people make so simple he's a deep thinker, and this country doesn't function in terms of deep thinking. Can you talk about when he's been able to move the country on certain issues? Because he's an extraordinary speaker. He's been able to have the combination of deep thinking, but explain it in a way that doesn't bore us, that may move us to some kind of action. Or has he fallen short on that mark?
Well, I think he's generally fallen short in persuading the country to move in his direction, but there have been moments, key moments, where he's delivered. When he's gone before Congress, all three speeches before Congress have been very well received. He got the stimulus and his budget better appreciated in his first address to Congress in early 2009. In September of 2009, he got health care back on track with a big speech before Congress, and then he was successful again in the State of the Union this year. So the problem is that the effect wears off very quickly, in part because he doesn't use sound bites, and he actually considers sound bites to be kind of a dirty word. And you know, my feeling about that is that if you look at, you know, Franklin Roosevelt's "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," or Abraham Lincoln's "A house divided against itself cannot stand," these are sound bites, and that he shouldn't be so allergic to them and should learn how to craft them more. He's worried about seeming phony, because authenticity is his ace in the hole. And he thinks that these lines can sound phony, and I think he should get over that worry and you know, connect in a way that leaves a lasting imprint on the consciousness of the public.
You talk about health care, and my God, that consumed our conversations for a year. We just talked about health care so much. Is he now in the company of FDR and Lyndon Johnson because of the passage of health care? Was it that big a deal?
Yes. This was a huge deal, and I think there was so much discussion about, you know, relatively small dimensions of the bill that people forget the totality of this, that it was the most sweeping social legislation since Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, and that, you know, is it perfect? Obviously not. You know, I was a public option man myself, actually a single-payer man, but I think people forget that these major pieces of legislation are a process. So in my last book, I wrote about Social Security in 1935, and so many New Dealers were against it because they thought the bill didn't go far enough, and they were right. It only covered fewer than 40% of seniors, and it was a racist bill. And yet Roosevelt understood that you have to start somewhere, and you have to begin that process, and he could go back and fix it, but that, as Obama likes to say, the perfect shouldn't be the enemy of the good. And so this health care bill will be fixed. But if it hadn't passed, we wouldn't have tackled this issue after all the conversations that you and others had, for another 30 years, right? Because it had to pass. He put all his chips on it. it almost came apart. I've got a scene where he's told that Martha Coakley is dissing Fenway Park in Boston, which is a shrine, and he grabs David Axelrod's shirt and says, "Tell me she didn't say that. Tell me she didn't say that." And he realized, you know, that that his dreams of his presidency, at least momentarily for several weeks, were in tatters. So he and Nancy Pelosi fought their way back and got the bill through, and it was a very big deal. It had a lot of things going on that were not reported at the time. All those many months you were having conversations about it, there was a whole backstory that I try to tell the reader about, the reader who's interested in healthcare. In a couple of chapters, I tell them all the things they didn't know that happened last year. There was a secret plan in the White House, for instance, an 800-page plan they had drafted, and a lot of other parts of this. That the most fascinating to me was, as I mentioned, that Obama essentially did this alone over the objections of his people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yet he was accused of being so disengaged from everything. He's always accused of that, isn't he? He's just disengaged from healthcare, disengaged from the oil. And you wonder why somebody doesn't realize he needs to be, he's got to use the media in those instances to let people know that there are things going on, and yet he just kind of lets it happen. What's going on with that?
Well, part of the criticism is valid that, you know, he never found the right vocabulary to talk about these things, as Valerie Jarrett admitted. And but part of it is a strategy. You know, if he had, I think a lot of liberals wanted him to just wave a magic wand and thought that if he just gave the right speech or took the bill immediately to the floor of the Senate that it would pass because he was Barack Obama. But that's just not the way politics works. And he understood that if he went around the Senate Finance Committee, that those moderate Democrats wouldn't vote for the bill on the floor. So there was a lot of cunning here. Now, he made a series of tactical mistakes, which I explain. It's not like he played a perfect hand on this or anything. And sometimes he did seem too detached from the process, even though he wasn't. He was, you know, holding countless meetings with members of Congress. His temperament and his own lack of neediness makes him a little bit less sensitive to the basic neediness of most other politicians. Mm. And so the stroking that you have to do is learned behavior for him. It doesn't come as naturally as it might. He does it, but you know, if he had his druthers, he'd rather be up in the residence reading a tome on nuclear nonproliferation and watching C-SPAN. watching ESPN.
ESPN, right. Yeah. And he doesn't particularly like people stroking him either, right?
No, he hates that. Huh. He hates kiss-ups and suck-ups. And, you know, on the day he got the Nobel Peace Prize, the people around him knew better than to make a fuss over it because he felt like he didn't really deserve it and was a little embarrassed by it. And the quickest way to alienate him is to fawn over him.
Mm-hmm. You got to like that about somebody. At least I do. I'm with him on that. I don't like people to fawn. You talk about Axelrod at one point in the book, figuring there were only two issues that could stop Obama, unemployment and Afghanistan. Would you, Jonathan, agree with that? And would you add to that?
Well, I think the third thing, the book was finished. It gets the full healthcare story in, but it was finished before the BP disaster. You have to add to that, unanticipated crisis that can always swamp a president, and you know, this, if he doesn't handle this right, it has the potential to cause him serious political damage. But of the things that you could see on the horizon, pocketbook issues are always critical, and if you have a foreign war that goes badly, that can be critical. I thought that healthcare, even if he lost, it would have wrecked the rest of his domestic agenda. And he thought that Obama told me that he thought, you know, that he had told Nancy Pelosi, he had predicted he'd go down 10 to 15 points, and he told her that it could cost him reelection. But I think Axelrod's right that even if he had lost that, he still could have been reelected, as Bill Clinton was after he lost on a much smaller health care plan. And Trying to figure out what's going to happen ahead is very tough business. And when I asked the president if he'd be reelected, he said rightly, it's too soon to tell. So what I try to do in the book is kind of the opposite of what, yakkers like me do on television, where we're always asked to predict the future. And I instead tried to look at it as a historian to try to say, look, this was a history-making time that we all lived through. So let's try to, even though we don't have the perspective of time, to deepen our sense of history. I could at least use my access to the president and vice president and people around them to paint a fuller historical picture and focus on the past rather than making lame predictions about the future.
Right. Jonathan Alter is our guest, the first part of this hour. His book is The Promise, President Obama, Year One. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, if you'd like to use that route. And we'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Jonathan Alter, starting with Frank in Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi,
thanks,
Frank,
for the topic and your guest, a fine guest. I have a sense that there's a degree of disappointment in Obama, and I thought and still think that he is what he ran as, that he ran as someone who was going to attempt to change the tone in Washington, and that he was a Burkean liberal, actually somewhat conservative. He was, and was not going to be confrontational. I wonder if that's the case, if he is what he is performing as he had promised us. And then second, did he in fact have that moment where he said, like Franklin Roosevelt, if you want more, you must force me to do it?
Yeah.
So, that push, the populist push in a progressive direction is not actually there. Hmm. So we do have the man who ran for the presidency. And will circumstances force him into doing more, in the opinion of the guests? So thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank.
Two great questions. First of all, I think you're right that he is authentically who he said he was, for the most part. He did say that he was going to try to end some of this partisanship, and he did try. He reached out to the Republicans early on the stimulus, and they just cast his hand aside. So he was not successful in that effort, and that's one of the failures of his first year. But he did try, as he promised. And if you look at, one of the reasons I call it the promise is not just his great promise in a larger sense, but I tried to add up how he did in the 500 specific promises he made. And according to PolitiFact, a nonpartisan Pulitzer Prize-winning website, he kept in his first year or made great progress in keeping close to 400 of his 500 promises. So he really did make a big effort to do what he promised he would. And as far as the comment about Roosevelt, who said to a labor leader when asked why he didn't do something, he said to the labor leader, "Make me." And that is Obama's attitude. And he said in the campaign, "We are the ones we've been waiting for. The we didn't show up to those town meetings last summer, right?" So the progressives neglected to turn out in the numbers that the conservatives did, and so they didn't. They made some noise on cable TV. They tried in the race yesterday in Arkansas to punish Blanche Lincoln for not being for the public option, and they failed. The left, I don't think, can expect that just because they make, some noise that Obama is going to move left. They have to show up and not assume that he could just wave a magic wand and have a more progressive country, but he is a progressive and is moving in his own slow and steady way, sometimes a fast way in 2009 toward that toward those progressive goals, but with pragmatic means. He's a pragmatist, and that's something that I think not everybody understands. John F. Kennedy described himself as an idealist without illusions. And I think that fits Barack Obama as well.
Yes,
hey, Kathleen, can I tell you a quick Wisconsin story?
Oh, we'd love it.
That's in the book.
Of course.
Congressman Steve Kagan from Green Bay, who's a very smart and very funny member of the House, was in a meeting with other House Democrats and Tim Geithner early in 2009, when the bailouts were just, as they continue to be, even after the money's been paid back, immensely unpopular. And he was trying to convey to Geithner how unpopular the AIG bailout in particular was in his district. And he said, you know, Tim, I'm from Green Bay, Wisconsin, and we had a coach there, the Green Bay Packers, Dan Devine, who got so unpopular at one point that an irate fan shot his dog. And he said, Tim, do you have a dog?
I just thought it was very funny,
and it kind of cracked up the House Democrats because it encapsulated how they all felt about Geithner at that moment.
Yeah. And why don't we talk just a little bit more about that? Because I think people have been highly critical of Obama for his appointment of some of those people who are associated with Wall Street to guide him in these important, really important financial matters that started his presidency. You talk about his preference for experience that came with a price and insularity, surrounded by advisors, infused with the values of Wall Street, even if they had only studied the market from academia or regulated it in government, not made money there. What about his advisors in this regard? How did he go that route, and has it served him well or ill?
Well, you know, he made a number of right decisions on preventing another depression. And remember, Kathleen, if we'd stayed on the path we were on, losing 740,000 jobs a month in January of 2009 when he took office, we would have been in another Great Depression, no exaggeration, by the end of 2009. So a number of the things they did were right. But I'm critical of Obama and the people around him for, A, having too tight a circle of advisors, not getting a wide enough array of advice. And so he excluded Paul Volcker, for instance, who's kind of the most populist of the bunch, if you can believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is related to having too tight a circle, not using his leverage over the banks at the time he had it in early 2009, when they could have essentially dictated terms to the banks. And I think if there had been if he'd had some more help on Capitol Hill, where Dick Durbin was kind of a fairly lonely voice, with the help of Russ Feingold and very few others, in going after the banks, I don't know if you remember a Wisconsin congressman named Henry Royce.
Of course, our building is named after him, one we're in right now.
You know, he was chairman of the House Banking Committee in the 60s and 70s, and you know, they and Wright Patman from Texas, there used to be an understanding of how to restructure the banks and keep them small. And it's Geithner and Larry Summers convinced the president that the banks were too brittle to mess with too much in early 2009. So now we've got this regulatory bill, and it's better than nothing. You know, I'm a half a loaf person, or a quarter of a loaf. But it's not what it could have been if they had pressed hard for financial regulatory reform when they had the leverage in early 2009.
Yeah. Let's go to thanks, Frank, as always, for your call. Paul in La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Last November, Norm Ornstein wrote that Obama was the most successful first-year presidency since FDR. And he said, And that was, of course, before health care was passed. So now, you know, like what you were saying here, it's pretty much a slam dunk. He belongs in that company. But a couple weeks ago, I was in my hometown, and talking to some guys I've gone to high school with, and there is no way that they would ever acknowledge the fact that Obama has done anything in this first year. That he's, you know, they really truly believe he's trying to destroy America. That the stimulus didn't work. It's going to cost us billions of dollars for health care. He doesn't salute the flag. All this stuff is still there. I'm wondering, does Obama just ignore these people, or does he actually think that he can win them over?
Well, it depends on whether they're in that, you know, what I call the fearful fifth, the 20% of, you know, Tea Party folks who just get all their information from Fox. And if they do, then he's never going to win them over. And you know, he, I think, rightly complains that, you know, he's the first president who's had a 24-hour network devoted to attacking him and, in some cases, you know, peddling lies about him. And so I doubt that those folks will be won over. There's a whole much larger group, though, of independents who right now, many of whom voted for Obama, and I don't know whether your high school friends did or not, but it's the ones who voted for him, and you got 54% of the vote in 2008, and it's those independents, some of whom have soured on him. Those he needs to get back. But I think those folks are more open-minded. And remember, even with Fox's ratings, it is way less than 10% of the American public, of the voting electorate, that watches Fox News. You had 130 million people voting in the 2008 election, and you know, I don't know, a couple million of them watch Fox at any given time. So it's important not to confuse the lay of the land here. But he does have a problem with independence. He did lose some of his connection to the American middle class. He has time to get it back. But he's up against a very determined obstructionist opposition.
Yeah. Can you tell us the stories that are in the book? I found them so disheartening. Of the meetings that I believe it was Axelrod had with Ailes and Murdoch, wasn't it? Who I think was going to support Obama, and what happened in that meeting?
There were a couple of meetings. One was in 2008, in the summer of 2008, and Murdoch was very taken with Obama, and Obama kind of wanted to break bread with him, and he went up to New York and, you know, sort of asked them to stop spreading this stuff about him, and Murdoch was very receptive until Ailes came into the room, and Ailes took a hard line, and then Ailes threatened to quit if Murdoch didn't come around to his view. And so the New York Post and other Murdoch properties quickly endorsed McCain. They resumed beating up on Obama. Then, after he became president, Axelrod went up to this was at the time when the White House was engaged in what I thought was an ill-advised boycott of Fox, essentially, you know, not giving the White House correspondent any interviews or letting him really, you know, returning any of his phone calls. And because the Fox commentators, their work was leaking over into the news coverage, and the White House rightly resented that. But, you know, if they can talk to Iran and you know, thugs around the world, they can talk to Fox. So I thought their strategy was wrong on that. But to try to, you know, mend some fences, Axelrod went up and had a very chilly meeting with Ailes last year. And afterward, Axelrod said that, you know, it reminded him of the extremists when he was growing up who thought that fluoridated water was a plot.
Oh, my gosh.
And he just thought that, right. You know, because Ailes kept going with, you know, you're an extremist, a socialist, your president's a socialist, you know, this health care bill is socialism, it's a government takeover, and Axelrod said, hey, wait a minute, this bill is the Howard Baker Bob Dole bill of the 1990s. It is not a government takeover. It lets private insurance continue to function. And so stop, you know, distorting this, and Ailes just, you know, wasn't having any of it. And, you know, Roger Ailes is a very powerful, very successful guy. He's a thoroughly, and I know this from personal, you know, exposure to him, he's a thoroughly rotten human being and a bully. And I think when people come into close contact with him, they understand that.
Right. Do you have time for one more call?
Sure.
Okay, great. Let's go to, because I want to talk about this issue too. Barbara in Madison. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, good morning. Oh, what an opportunity to speak to you. I watch you and admire you so greatly, and how nice to hear from you this morning.
Well,
and,
thank you.
And I'm a Wisconsin old lady, and was so delighted to have this man elected president that my husband and I are both 84, and we just sat there weeping with joy. And we're delighted. I just think that he's a brilliant man, and we're fortunate to have him. And I hear this shouting about, we want our government back. Are these people talking in a racial manner? And what a percentage of the people out there do you think are really screaming? Because very deep down, they may not want to admit it, but they have this racism going on in their very being.
You know, it's a good question. I can't give you an accurate percentage. It's guesswork. I think it's some, but by no means all, of the Tea Party people who are motivated by racism. Remember, they called Bill Clinton a murderer and a drug dealer not too many years ago. And Franklin Roosevelt, the right wing, said that he didn't have syphilis, he didn't have polio, he had syphilis, and it had gone to his brain. I mean, so this kind of politics goes back a long way. It goes all the way back to what they were saying about Thomas Jefferson. And so some of it is motivated by race, by people feeling threatened. I think some of it is motivated by class, by the fact that they know that he, you know, and they fear that a well-educated class is you know, moving past them and leaving them behind. But as Obama said, you know, I was black before I was president, so people knew that they were voting for an African-American, and he won a very resounding victory. So do you always have 20% of the public that is going to be reactionary, as they used to be called? Yes. And I think at a certain point, there's been too much coverage of these very noisy Tea Party folks. You know, the pro-immigration folks went into the streets a million strong, and nobody even noticed it. This is just a few weeks ago, but there's a demonstration of maybe 10 or 20,000 Tea Party folks, and it's everywhere on cable. So it's important to keep this in perspective. And truth to tell, in the promise, I don't deal a lot with the whole Tea Party thing. It's in there, and I explain where it came from. But I'm more interested in telling people things they don't already know about this man, what he's like, and how he operates behind closed doors, and how he functions at work and at play when the cameras are off. And to me, that's the story that we don't know yet. And you know, my book is the first book about his presidency. We've read a lot about Barack Obama's past and his campaign, and the promise deals with what he's like now. And that's what I tried to do in the book.
And you did it very well. Thank you so much for being with us and for all your work, Jonathan.
Thanks, Kathleen. It was really a pleasure joining you.
Yeah, great to have you here. Jonathan Alter, the book is The Promise, President Obama, Year One. We continue our conversation for this Wednesday. Primaries all over the country yesterday, and a couple that we're going to pay special attention to took place in Arkansas and also in California and in Nevada. We'll have two guests with us to sort through what happened, and welcome your phone calls as well. We'll meet our guests in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.